Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Pope Francis landed Monday in the eastern city of Elgin, the second stop on a tour of the island nation, one day after meeting with the Castro brothers who have ruled Cuba since 1959. Elgin, 743 kilometers east of Havana, has been a cradle of the Catholic faith on the island and is known for a cross that has overlooked the town for centuries. It is also the home region of communist leaders Fidel and Raul Castro. The Pope celebrated Mass for tens of thousands gathered in Elgin's Revolution Plaza, urging Cubans to heed Jesus Christ's invitation to overcome resistance to change. During his homily, Pope Francis said Christ challenges the faithful daily to believe in the possibility of personal transformation. The United States is reportedly considering abstaining from a potential UN General Assembly vote calling for an end to its longstanding trade embargo against Cuba. But the U.S.-Cuba relations have taken a dramatic turn since the last vote in October 2014. In July, the two governments ended 54 years of antagonism and agreed to reestablish diplomatic relations. U.S. President Barack Obama publicly urged Congress to lift the embargo. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency said Monday significant progress has been made in the UN's long-running probe into allegations around work to develop nuclear weapons. Yukiya Amano said environmental samples were taken at the Parchin military site before his visit in a process that included Iranian representatives swiping samples. Authentication by the agency of the samples was achieved through use of an established verification process, Amano told reporters. The samples have been brought to Vienna and will be analyzed by agency experts. This is VOA News. The International Commission of Inquiry on Syria is calling on states to curb the flow of weapons to armed groups, which it blames for fueling the war that has killed nearly one quarter of a million people in Syria since March 2011. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA.
In a hard-hitting emotional presentation, Commission Chair Paulo Sergio Pinheiro told members of the UN Council that Syria has fallen apart before their eyes.
A nation has collapsed into the world's most chaotic and lethal battlefield. This war remains deadlocked as violence rips through the social fabric of Syrian society.
Pinheiro said all warring parties are deliberately targeting civilians who are the primary victims of this vicious conflict. He described government bombardments of civilian areas and indiscriminate shelling by anti-government armed groups. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Burkina Faso's army says its troops are moving toward the capital, Ouagadougou, with the intention of disarming the presidential guard that seized power in a coup last week. A military spokesman told VOA's French to Africa service that the army has issued a communique asking the presidential guard to surrender and move to an army base near Nation Square, a public gathering place in the capital. He said the army is waiting for a response from the guard known as RSP. The RSP overthrew the transitional civilian government last week. Protests against the coup turned violent, killing at least 10 people and injuring more than 100. Russian President Vladimir Putin and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu have agreed to coordinate the actions of their country's armed forces in and around Syria to prevent an unintended military confrontation. They met Monday at the Russian presidential residence just outside Moscow. Afterward, Netanyahu told reporters he and Putin had agreed on a mechanism to prevent such misunderstandings. Netanyahu said the talks were conducted in an atmosphere of mutual respect. Shares in German automaker Volkswagen plunged more than 13% Monday, just minutes after the Frankfurt Exchange opened, following news that many of its diesel cars in the United States had software that intentionally falsified emissions data. The trend continued into mid-morning trading, which showed VW down more than 20%. The huge drop comes one day after Volkswagen CEO Martin Winterkorn apologized for breaking the trust of VW's customers, saying the company will fully cooperate with an external investigation the automaker has ordered. Sales of Volkswagen's diesel cars have been halted in the U.S. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiyis Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The junta should step aside and allow preparations for October elections to resume immediately. The United States stands squarely with the people of Burkina Faso in rejecting this threat to their democratic progress.
That's U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice expressing support for democracy in Burkina Faso. Details coming up.
Also, suicide bombings rock northern Nigeria and Cameroon. Sea rescues of migrants continue as the European Union schedules another emergency meeting to resolve a worsening humanitarian crisis. And thousands of girls in the Horn of Africa are forced to marry while still being underage.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Gabon, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, suicide bombing continues to plague two West African countries over the weekend. In Cameroon, at least five people were killed in a bomb attack in the northern town of Mora. In northern Nigeria, witnesses say at least four explosions occurred late yesterday in Maiduguri. A hospital source says it has received eight bodies so far. Maiduguri City is the capital of Borno State, where Islamist Boko Haram militants remain active. Witnesses to the Maiduguri attacks say two of the explosions occurred at two mosques during final prayers of the day. Other explosions were reported at markets in Maiduguri. No group has claimed responsibility for any of the attacks, but Boko Haram has repeatedly used bombings since launching its insurgency in 2009. Boko Haram has pledged allegiance to the militant group Islamic State and has killed more than 10,000 Nigerians as part of a campaign to impose Islamic rule on northeastern Nigeria.
Efforts by West African leaders to return Burkina Faso to civilian rule are meeting with stiff opposition from the nation's new military leaders and by civil society groups that inspired the overthrow of longtime President Blaise Compaoré last year. The current head of the Economic Community of West African States, Senegal's President Macky Sall, says he will present ECOWAS proposal to a meeting tomorrow at the African Union. Weekend demonstrations have occurred at hotels in Ouagadougou, where negotiations were being held. More than 10 people have died in street clashes, and more than 100 have been wounded since the military coup.
Last Wednesday, the nation's presidential guard conducted a coup and detained interim president Michel Kafando, his prime minister, and some of his cabinet. They were later released. At issue was a government proposal to deny participation in an October 11th election to supporters of former President Blaise Compaoré. Compaoré's 27-year rule ended when popular demonstrations replaced him with an interim government. The new military junta, headed by Compaoré's former military advisor, General Gilbert Diendéré, left the fate of October 11th elections in doubt. Over the weekend, ECOWAS leaders mediated efforts to return to a civilian government. One of 13 proposals made by the mediators allows Compaoré's party to participate in an election that must be held by November 22nd. A civil society group that led the demonstrations against Compaoré, Balai City on Civic Broom, adamantly refuses to open up the elections to Compaoré supporters. Diendéré refuses to relinquish power until an election occurs.
U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice says the junta in Burkina Faso should step aside and allow elections next month. Maria Madiallo reports.
Susan Rice says the United States and the international community are united in responding to the crisis in Burkina Faso.
The junta should step aside and allow preparations for October elections to resume immediately. The United States stands squarely with the people of Burkina Faso in rejecting this threat to their democratic progress.
Speaking at the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation's legislative conference in Washington, Rice says the U.S. is reviewing its assistance to the West African country. In an ever-changing political landscape in Africa, Rice said more work to end old mindsets and address entrenched challenges needs to be done even after four presidential trips to the region, a historic summit in Washington, and signature development initiatives. She took a moment to praise the work of the Congressional Black Caucus.
Over the years, your leadership and that of the entire CBC has built a bipartisan consensus that gets things done for Africa, from fighting apartheid to supporting PEPFAR, from confronting the genocide in Darfur and easing the suffering of the people of South Sudan to tackling the Ebola crisis in West Africa.
U.S. Congresswoman Karen Bass, who sponsored the event, says it's important to move forward on trade, health, and governance a year after the landmark U.S.-Africa summit.
We started off the day by talking about the Ebola crisis, the fact that it's over, but the fact that the crisis revealed the need to really develop the health infrastructure in Africa. And then, of course, after the extension of AGOA was passed, we have a panel that's talking about trade. And now that AGOA has passed, let's really fast forward the implementation.
The African Growth and Opportunity Act offers trade incentives for African countries to open their economies and build free markets. Chevron manager for international affairs, who participated in the AGOA panel, made a plea to U.S. investors to encourage stable democracies.
When you look at Africa, think about the three P's: patience, physical presence, and partnership. This is the last frontier, and there are a lot of tremendous opportunities. Second, to the U.S. government, infrastructure is critical.
But he also asked African governments to enable an environment for Africans and foreign companies to come, feel safe, and then operate. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Sea rescues of migrants continue as the European Union schedules another emergency meeting to resolve a worsening humanitarian crisis. The Italian Navy reports rescuing almost 1,000 migrants in 42 search and rescue operations in the Mediterranean on Saturday. The Greek Coast Guard has rescued 70 migrants whose boat has run aground on the Greek island of Rhodes today. Meanwhile, European Parliament President Martin Schulz says he fears Wednesday's EU summit will resolve disagreements over migrants will end in discord. Schulz also says the European Council must raise money for Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey because there's no money anymore to help people in refugee camps in those nations. The EU is squabbling over proposals for EU nations to share 120,000 refugees.
The foreign ministers of the Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland, and Slovakia oppose migrant quotas. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orbán has told Parliament that the migrants are not just banging on our door, they are breaking it down. He added more razor wire fences on its border with Serbia, Croatia, and Romania are needed to stop the migrants and defend Hungary and Europe. His government is also advertising in today's edition of Lebanon's leading daily newspaper, An Nahir, saying, "The strongest possible action is taken in Hungary against people who attempt to enter Hungary illegally." Poland's foreign minister says Europe needs a united plan to address the ongoing refugee crisis. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry announced yesterday that the United States will increase the number of worldwide migrants it takes in over the next 2 years, 85,000 refugees next year and 100,000 in 2017. Many would be from Syria. Others would come from strife-torn areas of Africa.
Europe faces the task of processing hundreds of thousands of refugee applications and identifying those in genuine need of asylum. But as Henry Ridgewell reports from the Croatian-Serbian border, there are claims that some migrants are carrying fake Syrian passports, creating tensions with Syrian nationals.
Tens of thousands of migrants have walked along dusty tracks through the cornfields and across Serbia's border with Croatia in recent days, trying to reach Western Europe. VOA spoke to three Syrian men in their early 20s making that journey. They asked not to be identified and were quick to voice anger at some of the other migrants.
Too many people here have a Syrian and IDs, passports, and they are not Syrians. Yeah. They are from Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, too many.
And actually, I'm really shocked because this is our problem, this is our case.
Yes.
But Iraqi migrant Sadek told VOA he and his family should be entitled to asylum because they are escaping the Islamic State terror group known in Iraq as Daesh.
You must know this information for all the Europeans. The Daesh is not known just the Syrian, because the Daesh is coming from Iraq and the Syrian and everyone. That hit for everyone.
Mohammed, an asylum seeker from Afghanistan, voiced resentment at the focus on Syria.
Syrian refugee is all of process is very high, but the Afghan refugees, no. All of things for Syrian, not for Afghans.
Who is a genuine refugee fleeing conflict or persecution, and who is a so-called economic migrant escaping poverty or looking for a better life? Hungary, which is building fences on its southern borders to keep out all migrants, wants Europe to enforce the distinction. Zoltán Kovács is a government spokesman.
A joint European force that is able to stop illegal migration and establish the form, the protocol by which we are able to separate genuine refugees who are in real need of shelter from those who are only economic migrants.
European leaders plan to hold an emergency meeting on the crisis Wednesday. Many say part of any solution will be identifying the genuine refugees, but migration experts say the distinction is rarely black and white. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News on the Croatian-Serbian border.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight Live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Suicide bombing continues to plague two West African countries, one in northern Nigeria, another in Cameroon. And U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice says the junta in Burkina Faso should step aside and allow elections next month. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Thousands of girls in the Horn of Africa are forced to marry while still being underage. Marta Vanderwolf reports from Gondor, where the local government and UNICEF are organizing large awareness campaigns to change the attitude of rural communities.
60-year-old Hibis Ababayu from the town of Gondor was about to be married to a 28-year-old man when she was just 13. Last year, her parents again tried to marry her to another man. Hibis says her parents did not even tell her about the marriage, but her friends had overheard the arrangements and informed her. She says that immediately when she heard, she reported it to the school principal and to the lead teacher of the girls' club. They spoke to the police. After they negotiated with her parents, they managed to cancel the marriage arrangements. The girls' club Hibis joined in school is a place where information is provided to girls about child marriage through awareness interventions. Especially for rural communities, child marriage is the social norm. The local government says that raising awareness and changing the attitude of the community is the biggest challenge. The police, religious leaders, and development partners such as United Nations Children's Fund are involved in trying to change the mindset about child marriage and eliminate all forms of child marriage by 2025. UNICEF program worker Zemzem Shakur says child marriage has several consequences for the girl's life.
The first one is easily they are forced to drop out from school, which shapes their destiny to be a housewife or to be in a very different or vulnerable situation. The other one is the health consequence, because they don't get treatment easily, and they may not also have information where to get services.
One in five girls in Ethiopia are married before the age of 18. In Gondor, a northern region, almost half the underage girls are married, even though the legal age is set at 18. Hibis feels lucky to have been rescued. She says many of her friends are already married. She says the thinking in the community is to marry off children at a very early age, since they do not see why girls should get an education or how they can become somebody. One of the awareness campaigns in Gondor is an afternoon of musical performances on the main square. The event attracts large crowds, and the message appears to come across to the audience of mostly boys. They say they agree girls should not get married before the age of 18. Solomon Asefa is one of them.
ምክንያቱም ያለው አቅማቸው ራሱ ማለት ነው ሚጣና ሰውነታቸው የሚበረታ ማለት ነው.
He says girls first need to be physically ready to get married, then they have to be educated so that they can be what they want to be. Hibis is now in 8th grade school. She hopes her parents will allow her to attend university if she keeps receiving good grades. 40-year-old Abeba Ayele was less fortunate. She lives in a village an hour outside Gondor. She was forced into a marriage last year and now has a 6-month-old baby. Abeba says it is difficult to deal with the new attitude from her peers. She says everyone was gossiping about her when she was pregnant, and it gave her psychological problems. Abebe has registered for school again, but is not sure if she can attend, as she does not have the funds to look after herself and her baby. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Gondor.
During Pope Francis's 7-day visit to the United States, which begins tomorrow, there is sure to be the customary pomp, celebration, and ceremony on the grandest scale. But because Pope Francis is especially focused on serving the poor and marginalized, his itinerary also includes a Pennsylvania prison and a Catholic elementary school in Harlem, attended by children of Latin American immigrants. To help us understand this complex pontiff better, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Paul Vulali, the author of the recent biography Pope Francis, The Struggle for the Soul of Catholicism. Vulali began by explaining why it makes sense Francis would be one to shake up the church.
Well, he's a man who has had a change in his own life. He began as the leader of the Jesuits, quite a conservative, very authoritarian figure, and quite a divisive figure. He was sent off into exile by the Jesuits because he'd been quite a disruptive figure as well. And in that 2-year exile in Cordoba, the second city of Argentina, he underwent a transformation, and he came out of that a different kind of person, a different kind of leader, someone who listened and consulted. And he became a bishop. And he spent a huge amount of his time in the slums, which is not what bishops traditionally did in Latin America. He was known as the Bishop of the Slums, and he's now the Pope of the Poor. He wants a poor church for the poor. So he's someone who's undergone a journey of his own, and he sees the need for the church to undergo a similar journey, so that it's not focused on issues of sexual ethics so much, and it's focused more on economics and poor people and how they're left at the bottom of the heap. So he's switching the focus of the church from sex and money, and there are a lot of people who don't like that.
What was this transformation? Was it sort of a dark night, or you just got to like some of the people who were poor and said, I'd like to help them out, and it happens to align with what Scripture says? I mean, what was going on sort of inside?
When he became Pope, he gave an interview, an extraordinary interview, in which he said that he'd been terribly authoritarian and he'd been perceived as an ultra-conservative because of that, and that in Cordoba he had an inner spiritual crisis. But he came out with a different model of how to be a leader. And then he spent 20 years working in the slums a lot. And the experience of poverty and the complexity of poor people's lives, he met people who were drug dealers and prostitutes, and he began to see that they had problems and they were victims in their own way. They weren't just the villains of the piece. Later on, when there was a huge financial crisis in Argentina, in 2001, Argentina underwent the biggest debt default in world history. And half the population were plunged below the poverty line. And Bergoglio, as he then was, began to be very critical of the economic systems which had created this, and also of the solutions which economists based in Washington at the IMF, the World Bank, and so forth, wanted to impose upon the local economy in a way which brought terrible hardship, public spending cuts, austerity, and all that kind of thing, and the people at the very bottom of the heap suffered. So he began to be critical of economic systems and say, they need to be reordered so that they work better for the people at the bottom. Previous popes have been critical of unrestrained capitalism, as they call it, and the important word there is unrestrained, but they critique them from a kind of philosophical, theological point of view. Francis is different because he speaks with much more passion. He's much more ferocious in his condemnations, and that's what's alarmed conservatives.
Climate change is another big issue for him.
Climate change, he sees as the same problem. There is a short-term pursuit of profit without any further thought for the long-term consequences, and that's what's caused the problems with the environment, with pollution, and now with global warming. And it's also what caused the problems of leaving poor people at the bottom of the heap and disposing of them. He talks about the economics of exclusion. There are people who are just not part of the global economy, and they are thrown away. He talks about the throwaway culture. Consumerist society doesn't just throw away things, it throws away people.
I'm wondering if Francis is trying to walk a line between being fully passionate on the one hand and being fully transcendent in terms of his ultimate frame of reference on the other.
Well, he's a man of great simplicity, but he's also a very sophisticated political operator. The two things are not mutually exclusive because he is, in fact, both.
That was part one of VOA's Adam Phillips's conversation with Paul Vulali, author of Pope Francis, The Struggle for the Soul of Catholicism. In part two, Mr. Vulali discusses Pope Francis's evolving relationship with Africa's estimated 170 million Catholics. This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
The best footballers must have dedication and teamwork. And to end malaria, we need this same unity. Malaria stops footballers from scoring and children from learning. Join with footballer Didier Drogba.
Malaria is preventable and treatable.
Join with leaders like President Museveni.
United, we can beat malaria.
Sports fans, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. And on Fridays, you can also hear my 30-minute show at 17:30 UTC. On the internet, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Check voaafrica.com for the addresses and enjoy the show.
What's up, Africa? It's Jackson Vunganyi.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Cape Town.
Can I be upfront with you? That's exactly what Nadia and I plan to do every Wednesday at 17:30 UTC. Upfront looks at issues that affect you.
Since the world is moving at a faster rate, they need to have a native computer.
Interesting news.
Canadian man was sentenced for drunk driving after being pulled over in his mother's motorized wheelchair. 35-year-old man was fined and placed on probation.
And of course, music.
No clouds in my stones.
Entertainment, celebrities, you name it, we'll talk about it.
And of course, we love to hear from you. Send us your thoughts and comments. Our email address is upfront@voanews.com.
So don't forget to check us out every Wednesday at 17:30 UTC on The Voice of America.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Suicide bombing continues to plague two West African countries over the weekend. And U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice says the junta in Burkina Faso should step aside and allow elections next month. Coming up, we'll have music from Gabon. And in our feature segment, in Ghana, 34 judges are being investigated for taking bribes and extortion in the biggest scandal to hit the nation's judicial system. I'm Kim Lewis with Ihaya Swuheap, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand the All-Africa Games top your sports report.
Kim, Egypt dominated the medals table at the 11th All-Africa Games, which officially ended over the weekend in Congo, Brazzaville. The Egyptians won 217 medals, 73 more than second place Nigeria. The Egyptian team tallied 85 gold, 64 silver, and 68 bronze. Meanwhile, Nigeria's total included 47 gold, 55 silver, and 42 bronze. South Africa was third on the medals table with 122 medals, 41 gold, 41 silver, and 40 bronze. This competition marked the 50th anniversary of the All-Africa Games, as well as their return to Brazzaville, which hosted the first edition in 1965. Mark Ouma reports on some of the medal winners on the final weekend of action.
In table tennis, hosts Republic of Congo had something to cheer on the final day of competition after they bagged two bronze medals in the men's and women's contest. Egypt won the women's gold medal, while Nigeria bagged the silver medal. In the men's contest, it was the reverse, as Nigeria prevailed while Egypt settled for the silver medal. In handball, Egypt pipped Angola 25-23 to win the men's event, while the Republic of Congo edged Nigeria 32-29 to claim the bronze medal. In the women's contest, Angola beat Cameroon 33-29 to clinch the gold medal, as Senegal pipped Nigeria 25-24 to claim the bronze medal. They're playing basketball. We love that basketball. In basketball, Angola beat Egypt 83-73 to win the men's game, as Nigeria edged Mali 57-55 to bag the bronze medal. In the women's contest, Mali emerged champions, Nigeria was silver medalist, and Angola claimed the bronze medal.
Thanks, Mark. That's Mark Ouma of our Daybreak Africa radio show. Senegal and Ghana won the men's and women's football titles at the All-Africa Games in Congo, Brazzaville. The VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Shegun Dot on the spot, Adeyemi, has that story as well as some athletic news.
Good evening, Africa. Senegal has won the men's football gold at the 11th edition of the four-yearly All-Africa Games, which rounded off Sunday in Brazzaville, the Congolese capital. The Senegalese beat Burkina Faso 1-0 to win the gold. Moussa Seydi scored the goal 84 seconds into the game. It was the first gold for Senegal in the history of the men's football event at the Games. Nigeria, which had been favored to win the gold in the under-23 football event, could only get the bronze after beating host Congo 5-3 on penalties. Both teams played goalless at regulation time. It was the third bronze for Nigeria in men's football since the competition started, as the country previously finished third in 1991 and 1995. With Senegal winning the gold, Burkina Faso the silver, and Nigeria the bronze, This is the first time in the history of the games that the gold, silver and bronze football medals will be won by teams from the same region. Senegal, Burkina Faso and Nigeria are all in West Africa. In women's football event at the Games, Ghana clinched the gold medal, also for the first time since the game started 50 years ago. The Ghanaians beat Cameroon 1-0 in the final. The victory was a sweet revenge for the Black Queens, who lost by a similar margin to their Cameroonian counterparts at the final of the 2011 edition of the Games in Maputo, Mozambique. Ivory Coast won the women's football bronze after defeating Nigeria 2-1 in the third place match.
Voice of America!
Turning to athletics, African runners won the men's and women's titles at the 35th edition of the Beijing International Marathon in the Chinese capital. The men's title was won by Kenyan veteran Mariko Kiplagat Kipchumba, ending the three-year Ethiopian winning streak. Kipchumba, who is 41, stayed at the leading group from the start of the race and clocked 2 hours and 11 minutes to finish first. The time is 5 minutes shy of his personal best of 2 hours, 6 minutes and 5 seconds. Pre-race favorite Berhanu Shifarau of Ethiopia came home second in 2 hours, 11 minutes and 37 seconds. Zimbabwe's Wirima Ejuwau, the 15th place finisher at the 2012 Olympics, finished third in 2 hours, 14 minutes and 25 seconds. The women's race turned out to be a straight fight between two Ethiopian runners, Abebe Jafewok and Bethlehem Moges. The 24-year-old Moges won in 2 hours, 27 minutes and 31 seconds. Afewok, who is also 24, was second in 2 hours, 29 minutes and 12 seconds.
VOA!
Staying with athletics, African runners will headline a world-class men's field at the 2015 New York City Marathon. The IAAF Gold Label Road Race will hold on November 1st. Defending champion Wilson Kipsang of Kenya and 5 other African runners occupy the top 6 places on the list of the elite men who are due to run in New York. Others include 2014 runner-up Lelisa Desisa of Ethiopia, who won this year's Boston Marathon, and 2014 third-place finisher Gebre Gebremariam, also of Ethiopia. Also on the list are world cross-country and half-marathon champion Jeffrey Kinworo of Kenya, Yemani Segai of Ethiopia, and Stanley Biwott of Kenya.
At Brooklyn, now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to the Narrow, but I'll be hood forever. I'm the new Sinatra, and since I made it here, I can make it anywhere. Yeah, they love me everywhere. I used to cop in Harlem, all of my Dominicanos right there up on Broadway. Pulled me back to that McDonald's, took it to my stash spot, 560 State Street. Catch me in the kitchen like a Simmons whipping pastry. Cruising down A Street, off-white Lexus, driving so slow, but BK is from Texas. Me, I'm out that Bed-Stuy, home of that boy Biggie. Now I live on Billboard, and I brought my boys with me. Say what up to Tata, still sipping my ties. Sitting courtside, Knicks and Nets give me high five. I be spiked out, I could trip a referee. Tell by my attitude that I most definitely from.
This is Larry Zamuje, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 18.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner the VOA.
VOA!
And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 18.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. In addition to Sports Radio, 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry also has stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. We're delighted to be your partner, Dr. Larry, so keep it sporty.
The Voice of America, VOA.
The Springboks of South Africa will try to bounce back from what's being described as the biggest upset in Rugby World Cup history. The Springboks, two-time World Cup champions, were stunned by Japan 34-32 in the opening match for both teams in Brighton, England. Substitute Carney Hesketh scored on the last play of the game to seal the upset victory for the Japanese, who some oddsmakers had as 1,000-1 underdogs before the match. It was only the second win in 25 World Cup matches for Japan. South Africa's head coach is Heinicke Meyer. Hey, coach, was this a wake-up call for your team?
So there's no easy games, but if this is not a wake-up call, nothing will be a wake-up call, but it's going to be tough. Every game is tough, and I think I've said before the World Cup, this is going to be the toughest World Cup ever. So I think there'll be more shock results, and again, I don't want to take anything away from Japan. They deserve to outplay us, but we have to pull together. It's not good enough, and we have to go through.
The South Africans will next face Samoa on September 26th in Birmingham, England. Samoa beat the United States 26-16 in their opening match. South African rugby fans were, of course, very disappointed with that loss to the Japanese. Let's listen in now to the reaction of three of those fans.
We should accept it and move on because, we just underestimated the opponents and the team just didn't play to its best possible. I've seen them play live here in SA. They are quite magnificent, but the way they played yesterday, you kind of get a feel that they thought the game in the bag, and it turns out that Japan were very spirited and they played well.
It was an excellent game of rugby. It's just a pity that we lost against Japan. But I don't think we were well prepared against or for what we expected against them. And I think our team is definitely too old. Old strategies, old players. But hopefully the next games, they will definitely do better.
I think it was a poor performance for our guys, right? Because I expected better, especially from Japan. Japan is not a team where we expect to just lose a match like that to us.
Some South African rugby fans reacting to the loss to Japan over the weekend. In other Rugby World Cup results from the weekend, host England kicked off the tournament with a 35-11 victory over Fiji in London. Wales walloped Uruguay 54-9 in Cardiff. Georgia topped Tonga 17-10 in Gloucester, England. Two-time World Cup champion New Zealand defeated Argentina 26-16 at Wembley Stadium in London. Ireland crushed Canada 50-7 in Cardiff, Wales. And France beat Italy 32-10 at Twickenham Stadium in London. Twickenham, by the way, is also where the Rugby World Cup final will be played on October 31st. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 hours UTC right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up in Ghana, 34 judges are being investigated for taking bribes and extortion in the biggest scandal to hit the nation's judicial system. And next, robots replacing humans in manufacturing. But first, some music. Here is Gabon's Oliver Ngoma with Kusu.
Botelema, Boningana, Bobina, la musique à Oliver Ngoma.
Misa beulumba titile lumo mulongwe, batitile lumba titimbongo amuro kwanga, ukanyo nikuye bailo, batimurime umwege.
Gabon's Oliver Ngoma with Kusu.
Ghanaian authorities are investigating 34 judges for taking bribes and extortion in the biggest scandal to hit the nation's judicial system. 12 high court judges and 22 senior judges were videotaped by investigative journalist Anas Aramaya Anas, who works for a newspaper called Crusading Guide. The chief justice has suspended the junior judges. 14 of them have appealed their suspension, saying they did not receive due process. The incident has unsettled the country, which prides itself on the efficacy and impartiality of its judicial system. Nana Osei-Busu is the chairman of the Ghana Anti-Corruption Coalition. Vincent McCorry asked him how deep the problem is and what can be done.
The expose has rattled the entire country, and, you know, there's always been a perception that corruption is rampant in the judiciary. But we always know that perception is more than reality. But at least for the time being, some have been captured in the cake. But the consolation is that there were others who also refused. So at least it's all not lost yet. But we are yet to see the depth and magnitude of what the corruption at that level in the judiciary.
Now,
at one level, it is.
Yes. Now, we know that Ghana has actually been enjoying a very good reputation on the international transparency level. It has been seen as ranking quite high compared to a number of African countries. How damaging might this become to that country?
Well, I mean, as you said, compared to other countries, is that what we want to always to be compared to the bad apples? No, we want to be compared with the good. So as much as transparency is better than others, we will want it to be at the highest level. So we expect that the people entrusted with some respect and, you know, rules and rules and regulations to manage the fair system of the law should be above reproach. So this is what has really caused concern. But as I said, because of the general perception over the years that the corruption is at the height of the judiciary, this expose may give the reality to the fact, and then people will come to terms that it's not all that bad, or it's not all that as we had always anticipated. And also to afford the country the opportunity to create the avenues and institutional framework to eradicate this endemic that is eating the country.
What's your assessment of the immediate steps that have been taken by the judiciary itself and the government?
Oh, we think that it's great that the Chief Justice has initiated immediate action and suspended those they think are, you know. But we also have to make sure that individual privacy and rights are not breached upon and that they're protected. But I think it's for the public good that everything is exposed to the public to know. So the whole entire country will see the bad apples, and we see the level and the depth of the corruption, and also that the right of the citizen will be protected as well.
Well, in terms of confidence in the system, what could be done eventually to really restore confidence? Because some have said, if you're wealthy in Ghana, you can buy justice.
Yeah, to boost confidence is prosecution. You have institutional frameworks already in place, but the resource for the institutions to participate or to do what they need to do had been not been available, either the technical skills or the financial resources to do what they do. And then even when they have done to the level where you need prosecution, it has not happened. So the people's confidence level have been lowered to the point that they think that nothing would ever be done so far as prosecution. So what we're looking for is, can we review our institutional framework and see whether we have the capacity to prosecute, in the sense that if there's no prosecution angle, where you have the SHRAG, the Center for Human Justice and all, if that cannot happen, then let's create an independent prosecutor or independent prosecutor office who would handle all investigations and prosecute those who are found wanting and found with their pants down.
Mr. Osei-Busu, what role should organizations like yours play, and what have you been doing about this?
Our role normally is to educate the public, the awareness, and to create in the minds of the public that it's not a one-man championship game. It's a collective effort of the citizenry and the institutions. So we believe that, but the difficulty for us as an institution, as a coalition, is the financial resources to create the human resources, to do the investigations, to do the awareness creation, to train even the little players on the ground that how do you refuse corruption? How do you refuse a demand? Right. How do you attend to blow the whistle when you find that? You know, the resource availability is very necessary.
That was Nana Osaibusu. He's the head of the Ghana Anti-Corruption Coalition. He was speaking with reporter Vincent McCorry.
Robots have replaced many humans in manufacturing. For example, cars are wielded and painted without human involvement. Other industries and professions are adopting robots, leaving humans without those jobs. Michael Osborne is an associate professor and researcher at Oxford University's Martin School. Reporter Jeffrey Young asked him about a study, The Future of Employment, How Susceptible Are Jobs to Automation?
Due to advances in machine learning and mobile robotics is that it's not just kind of routine manual labor that's under threat, but increasingly cognitive labor. So what that means is that jobs like insurance appraisers, tax preparers, and even a lot of sales jobs are increasingly under threat.
I was reading in one publication that one aspect of automation that could be possible would be taxi drivers. Now that we have self-driving cars, just get in the cab and speak your destination and this automated car takes you there. Really?
There has been remarkable progress in autonomous vehicles or self-driving cars, but I think what we'll see first is the automation of driving tasks that are relatively structured. So what that means is we're probably likely to see the automation of forklift drivers, people who drive agricultural vehicles or mining vehicles before we see taxi drivers automated away.
Now, you were talking about tax preparers and other white-collar workers. They could be doing the job instead of human beings?
That's right. So, I mean, obviously, algorithms are increasingly adept at not just storing information, but accessing it rapidly and even doing relatively subtle processing of that data. So it turns out a lot of traditionally white-collar jobs really just revolve around those sort of tasks. So we've already seen the automation of people like paralegal occupations, a bunch of other clerical occupations, and I mentioned before retail operations where the recommendation of products to customers can perhaps be better performed by an algorithm.
One thing that I was thinking about is the difference between a robot and a human being is that human beings can nuance in so many different layers. Is robotics capable of nuancing?
Where we've made progress in kind of bringing automation to even nuanced tasks is with the gathering of sufficiently large data sets. So to take one example, consider machine translation, which is the automated translation of written text from one language to another. So that's very much a task which you might have thought would require a lot of nuance, a lot of subtle understanding of cultural context. So the canonical example is that of the UN, which is required to translate its documents into 6 different constituent languages, perform translation by, first of all, identifying a small phrase that they want to translate, finding in that corpus of documents, and then they can make use of those 5 immediate translations into different languages.
That was Michael Osborne, a researcher at Oxford University's Martin School. He was speaking with reporter Jeffrey Young. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Kwame Afori, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Since the separation of South Sudan in July 2011, the Republic of Sudan's economy has spiraled downward. The loss of 75% of its oil revenue, along with ongoing conflict in parts of the country, particularly the Darfur, Blue Nile, and Kordofan regions, has caused massive displacement of the population and, as a result, a disruption of food production. This means that large segments of the population are going to bed hungry every night. Today, some 4 million Sudanese people are in desperate need of food assistance. In a bid to head off a potential food insecurity in Sudan, the United Nations World Food Programme, or WFP, aims to deliver food and nutrition to around 2.3 million people. Another 715,000 will receive food in payment for helping to create or restore community infrastructure or to help increase the incomes of their fellow citizens by providing support and skills. The United States is assisting the WFP wherever possible. Through the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, the United States government is contributing $86 million in food assistance to the WFP to be used for the benefit of those in need of assistance in Sudan's Darfur, North Kordofan, and West Kordofan states. Of the $86 million donated, $75 million will purchase about 69,000 metric tons of U.S. food. The remaining $11 million will come in the form of food vouchers, allowing voucher recipients to make their own choices from a variety of food items. This funding will also include enough cash for WFP to purchase more than 103 metric tons of locally produced specialized nutrition products to prevent and treat malnutrition in children under age 5. This most recent contribution brings the total U.S. government food assistance for Sudan to $170 million this year. The American people, this time working through WFP, remain committed to helping vulnerable Sudanese, said U.S. Chargé d'Affaires Ambassador Jerry Lanier. We hope that current conflict ceases soon, so there will no longer be need for food assistance in Sudan.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.